And we're all set. Okay. All right, let's go around the room and introduce ourselves. And this is for the universe now, because you'll be uploaded in the podcast, and your aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews will be able to hear you. Not just me making a fool of myself, but you making fools of yourself. Who are you, sir?
Davidson Lamar.
Davidson Lamar. And are you a matriculating student here? You're a regular UMass student?
Regular UMass.
And what's your major?
Criminal justice.
Criminal justice. All right, here's the $24,000 question, as they say. What year are you in?
Sophomore.
And you can say that straight out?
Yep.
So you're not a sophomore with one more course to finish before you're actually in your sophomore year?
No.
And you're not a sophomore with an additional course toward your junior year, nothing like that?
I don't think so.
Wow. You know, you are one of a small set of elite UMass students. Whenever I've asked this question over the years, what I get is, I'm sort of a sophomore, I think. I've got, you know, 57 credits, but I got to put in, I have to make up 13 of them before, you know what I'm saying? That's generally the answer I get. Where do you live?
I live in Brockton.
In Brockton, and what do you want to do when you grow up?
I'm doing my job right now. I'm a state trooper.
You're a state trooper. Listen, can you fix tickets? Look, you and I have to,
on the grade, I guess.
We'll have a discussion after class. I'm willing to barter. Listen, the only reason why I have students introduce themselves is to figure out what I can get from them. And we've started off very nicely here, I have to say. I might want a bigger favor before we're done. You know, sometimes arrests also happen. Yes, who are you?
My name is Janice. I'm a transfer student from Bunker Hill. Uh-huh. And I think I'm a junior, pretty sure.
All right, that's a better answer. And what's your major?
I'm studying to be a math teacher.
A math teacher?
Yeah.
Wow, you know, there are jobs for that. There are actually jobs out there for math teachers. My God. So you're going to be one of the few residents of Massachusetts who will actually be working. Yeah, and you said you're a junior?
Yeah.
Now, what's the situation at UMass? Are you able to graduate with a teaching certificate or what? How does that work?
I believe so, yep.
Yeah, because I know that there's a graduate college of ed, but...
You can major in, like, education, or you can major in whatever you're teaching.
You can major in math or in...
I can major in math, or I can major like this.
So are you taking education classes to certify? Okay, all right, yeah. Very good. And who are you?
My name is Carolyn. I'm a freshman. I'm a nursing major.
Ah, nursing major.
This is my second semester.
It's your second semester. So you're not in the nursing school yet, or are you?
I'm in nursing school.
Oh, you are in the nursing school. That's a good school. That program has a really good reputation, and it's pretty rigorous too. You know, it's a lot of hard work. Do you find yourself liking it?
I love it.
You do? Yeah. And how did you decide to become a nurse?
Because I did physical therapy before, but I didn't enjoy it so much, so I decided to do nursing because it's more engaging than physical therapy.
Right. And so do you have any friends who are physical therapists who could treat me for nothing? Any connections with pharmacies, anything like that? Any free drugs? No? No? All right. I'll have to wait for you, in other words, to get my... Yes. And who are you?
Hi. My name is Bing.
What part of China?
The central part of China.
What's the region?
The city is called
Wuhan.
Wuhan. Yeah. Yeah. Have you heard of it?
Yeah. When I was a freshman in college, I was a Chinese studies major.
Oh.
And I took Chinese. I took intensive Chinese.
You can speak Chinese. You can talk to...
I'm sorry?
You can talk Chinese.
I took intensive Chinese, the language, for a year. And it was 2 hours of classes every day. An hour of language instruction, of language lab work, and then an hour of character study. And I did that 5 days a week for my entire freshman year. And then, after I was done, I said to myself, what, am I crazy? And I stopped studying Chinese. And I must have learned about 600 characters and and I had conversational ability, but that was a long, long time ago. I don't remember any of it. I remember some of the characters, and I can read, some ancient Chinese, but nothing. When I try to talk to contemporary Chinese people, they laugh at me, so I've stopped doing that.
Have you heard about the Chinese philosophy, Tao Te Ching?
Yeah, oh yeah. I actually teach. No, say it again. Say it so soon.
How could he is love?
Yeah, the Tao Te Ching. Actually, I teach that in my introductory class, introductory philosophy class.
Yes.
He's one of my favorites.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Absolutely. And so, how long have you been in the States?
Almost 2 years.
Well, welcome. And do you have, did I ask if you had a major?
Yes, I'm a major in accounting, in management.
Yeah, and you're reading Laozi?
Yeah.
In the Tao Te Ching?
Yeah.
Leave accounting. Laozi would never have been an accountant.
Yes, that's my favorite.
Yeah, and Zhuangzi would have been an accountant even less. My suggestion to you is to leave the School of Management, get a hut somewhere in the woods, and just enjoy the days. Yes, and who are you?
Matt Janik.
Matt.
I'm a nursing major.
You're also a nursing
yes.
major. So you're in the nursing school already, right? The
yeah, I'm a sophomore. Yep.
Sophomore. And they have a graduate program here too, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Yeah. Do you like it?
I like it so far.
Yeah, yeah. I had a friend of mine used to be the chair of the nursing school, and Linda Dittmar. I don't know whether you know her, but in any event, I know it's a good program. I've taught medical ethics a couple of times over the years, and my medical ethics classes are always filled with nursing students, and they're always top notch. So you have to live up to that, and if you begin disappointing me, forget it. You're totally screwed.
My name is Johnny Shin.
Johnny?
I'm an engineering major.
Yeah.
I guess this should be kind of my junior semester.
This is your junior semester?
Yeah.
And you're Chinese by heritage, but were you born in the States?
I was born in the States. I was born in New York, raised in Boston.
Oh, you have a part of New York?
Manhattan.
Pardon me?
Manhattan.
Yeah, I never made it to Manhattan, but I lived in the Bronx and I lived in Brooklyn.
I was born in Manhattan, but I lived like a couple months in Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah. But then you moved to Boston.
I moved around.
Yeah. Yeah, Boston's a much easier city to deal with than New York. New York is very exciting. New York has everything imaginable. I remember I was staying with a friend of mine who actually also was Chinese American. He worked for a British violin dealer. He was living in London at the time. And he came to the States and he got a hotel room which had an extra room. And so he said, "You want to come and stay with me in New York?" And I said, "Oh, great." So I went down from Boston and I stayed with him in New York. And I must have been on maybe the 50th floor of a hotel on Broadway and 70th Street. And I was up around 2 or 3 in the morning, and I remember looking, this was on a weeknight, right? And I looked into the depths of Manhattan, and just all of the windows that were lit up with people inside doing things. It was amazing, you know? It was just this beehive of continuous activity. But then, of course, the downside of it is that you got to deal with Manhattanites.
And, I went there with a friend for one of those White Castle trainings.
Oh, yeah.
We were in Manhattan and we found one.
You were looking for White Castle?
Yeah, White Castle.
That was gross.
And then the thing is,
that's been around forever.
We saw like high school kids like up in like around 2 and 3 in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
School
there. Yeah.
Like school now.
And they call it the city that never sleeps. And
yeah, really.
It's true. Do you know the joke? The joke about this guy gets into New York, and he says, he meets a native New Yorker, and he says, "Do you have the time, or should I just go fuck myself?" Sorry about that, folks. Now that I got the F word out, I feel much better. And who are you?
My name is Shmila Reese, and I'm a second semester freshman. I transferred from an American International College in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Wow!
Yeah.
How in the world did you wind up there?
My family's from Argentina.
Your family is Argentinian?
Yeah.
But you sound like you were raised in the States.
I was born here. Spanish was my first language, but I lived in Argentina until I was about 5, and then I came here.
And then you came here.
Yeah.
And so you went back to college in Argentina.
Yeah, a lot of my cousins and stuff are there, and I wasn't sure where I wanted to go to school yet, so I was like, I'll take a semester and go to Argentina.
Oh, I see. But you decided not to do it in Argentina.
No, I had a lot of fun. I went there for a semester. It was just really hard to go back once I was home and had the comforts of being here. Like, public transportation stuff over there.
Yeah, Boston has a great public transit system,
yeah, no,
I'm telling
like,
you.
I have
it's fabulous. You know how many times it's broken down on me in the past year? I was commuting to a course downtown because UMass has a campus. You know, they rent space at the international school in Copley. And so I was commuting to Copley from, I was on the Green Line coming from Park Street into Copley. And the train stops. No, it doesn't just stop, but it's going along at a good clip, and it grinds to a halt, and it's the rush hour, so everybody's thrust forward on the train. So the woman driving the train, the conductor says, "Who called the emergency stop?" And she became very irate, you know, to find out who pulled the emergency stop. Well, she couldn't find out anybody. She couldn't find anybody who owned up to pulling the emergency stop. So she started again, grinds to a halt again. Everybody is thrown forward. Right? At this point, she realizes there's a problem with the train. It's not somebody pulling the emergency stop. It's the train. So she gets on the phone and calls Command Central to get assistance. Nobody answers. There she is, filled with a train load of rush hour commuters. You know, it's around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And she's got a major problem with her train, and she can't get any central help. So she does it again, right? She steps on the gas, whatever they do, right? And the train starts going along, grinds to a halt. Everybody is thrown forward a third time. She gets on the phone again. No answer. Finally, she says, "I swear to God," she says, "everybody hold on tight." This is, everybody hold on tight. So everybody is holding on tight, and she finally made it to Copley. But that is the MBTA's answer to a technical and safety problem. Everybody hold on tight. So congratulations, you picked a great city to come to if you want a good public transit.
Boston.
But it's gotten worse, hasn't it?
What?
It's gotten worse, hasn't it, in the MBTA?
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, like, there I had to take public transportation here. I have my car, so.
Oh, okay.
But I do take the T sometimes, but I had fun.
Let me tell you another story about the T. I'm really on a high horse about the T. The MBTA has major structural problems. I'm talking about the trains, right? They have major structural problems. So they hire an outside investigative company to come in and take a look around. I mean, this was, you know, an official hire by the MBTA. The report comes out. It came out no more than 2 months ago, no longer than 2 months ago. And the report says that there's all kinds of structural damage to the MBTA, the tracks, the trains, and so forth. And so they interviewed, this was the Metro, interviewed the guy who wrote the report. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing. I would never go on the train between Alewife and Harvard Square." And he said, "The reason why I wouldn't go on the train between Alewife and Harvard Square is that there's been water damage along the tracks between those two stations, and the water damage is eroding the ability of the train to hang on to the tracks. The tracks are actually coming up out of the concrete because of the water damage." That's my commute. That's my commute. And, you know, and the city did what it always does, or this was the state, I guess, who did it. After the report was issued, they brought in maybe 10 workers to go in and look around. And they made sure that there were cameras taking pictures of them, looking around at the damage underneath it. And that was the last anybody ever heard of it, right? So I'm still commuting on this damn thing that the guy who wrote the report said he wouldn't be quite dead commuting on. Go back to Argentina. Do you have a major, by the way?
I want to go to law school, so pre-law or social sciences.
Okay. In other words, you don't want to actually work for a living. Okay. All right. I started out wanting to go to law school, too. As a matter of fact, when I first began teaching here, I was teaching in the law and justice program, which was a fantastic program. Not criminal justice, law and justice. But we had attorneys teaching in it. We had a field placement for students who wanted to go on to law school, and it was also a lot of social theory. It was a great program, and of course the administration axed it because it was so popular. Yes?
My name is Ellen. I'm a junior. I'm a transfer student, and this is my first.
Where are you transferring from?
A small school in Pennsylvania.
Don't apologize about Pennsylvania. That's where my nephew lives. What's the school?
Gwen Mercy.
I have no idea where that is. So, and what year are you in?
I'm supposed to be a senior, but I took a year off, so.
See what I tell you. You were the last person who answered that question straightforwardly. Yeah. Do you have a major?
I'm psychology.
Psychology, yeah. Do you want to practice it when you get done?
I'm not sure what I want to do with my psychology degree yet.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, you can just like play mind games with your friends. That's okay. Okay. And who are you?
My name's Derek, and I'm from China.
Are you from China too? What part of China?
Beijing.
Oh, there's a town I heard of.
I'm a freshman here. Do you know Zhuangzi?
You are.
His theory is similar with Lao
Tzu. Oh, yeah. Actually, that's my favorite book in Chinese philosophy, is the Zhuangzi. Yeah. Yeah. And I teach that in my intro class as well. It's a wonderful book. And he's someone who would never be an accountant. They tried to get him to become a minister in one of the governments of China during the time. And he said, let me tell you a story. There is a turtle that the king keeps in his sacred chamber. It's a gigantic turtle that lived for 500 years before the king had it captured, killed, and desiccated and placed in his chamber where people come to pay homage to it. What do you think? Would you prefer being the king's turtle, or would you prefer being the same turtle dragging its tail through the mud? And the emissary of the king said, I would prefer to be a turtle dragging its tail through the mud. And Zhuangzi said, well, then get out of here and let me drag my tail. And in other words, he refused to take a position as minister because he wanted to have a decent life. You know the story I'm talking about? It's in one of the later books. But what's your major?
Business management.
Ah! Yeah, you're reading Zhuangzi? Leave the business world. Yeah, he left. He had a small position, as we are told, the keeper of the lacquer garden, whatever the lacquer garden was. And he quit in his relatively early adulthood and moved to the countryside, where he basically did nothing but hang out. He was one of the first hippies. And so my recommendation to both of you is that you follow his lead. Both of you should leave. And don't tell your parents, by the way, that I was the one who gave you this advice. And who are you, sir?
I'm Sean. I'm from China.
Sean is also from China. He's kidding. Sean is a wise ass. This is something I learned when I had him as a student last semester. Tell us about yourself, Sean.
I'm from Dorchester. This is my second year.
His second year? Yeah, he's from China, but with a Boston accent. Yeah.
It's my second year. It's my second semester with the wonderful Mrs. Emily. And I'm currently still undeclared.
You're undeclared?
I am undeclared.
Was it like you've gone going through customs or something? What do you mean you're undeclared? You haven't declared a major?
Yeah, I have not declared a major.
Ah.
I'm just here for the ride.
Ah, good. This is somebody who should benefit.
I'm just here to waste my money and wearing stuff.
Now you're talking about Zhuangzi. And who are you?
I'm Joe Shagnon. I'm a transfer student.
And where are you transferring from?
University of Tampa.
Tampa? And you're wearing a Boston cap already?
I'm from Boston.
Oh, you're from Boston.
I went to school in Tampa for 2 years.
Okay. I was going to say, you lousy, rotten traitor. I know. But they've got good preseason games, though, in the area.
You can go see the Red Sox real cheap while you're
yeah.
down there.
Yeah.
I think 4 games is about what a ticket to Fenway costs.
Yeah, I did that once, actually.
Yeah. I saw a lot of Red Sox games, yeah. The whole series.
The seats are terribly uncomfortable, though.
But those are really annoying cowbells, but
yeah. Yeah, right.
It's the South. You can't expect too much.
Do you have a major?
Yeah, I'm a psych major.
You're a psych major. Do you want to be a psychologist?
I want to work in animal behaviorism.
Animal behaviorism. And what's that? You train animals to collect pellets from... what do you do? Like a set... You turn them into assassins for their...
study social dynamics
You want to be a rat psychologist?
No. No, what? I work with larger animals. I've actually already worked with wolves, big cats, and marine mammals.
Oh, nice.
So ideally keep doing that.
So what do you tell a marine mammal when it gets depressed?
You just kind of give it a good pat on the back.
Yeah. And insurance covers that for psychotherapy. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, wow. That's incredible. It must be hard to work with the octopi. Yeah, okay. I understand what you're saying. Animal behavior is really a terrific field. I don't encounter too many students who are interested in it, but it's a great field. And there's some great path-breaking work that was done in it in the 20th century, including the stuff on behavior. But you're interested in mammals and relatively advanced mammals, right?
Predators.
Yeah, interesting. My brother-in-law is the director of a zoo in Florida. And I love what they've done on this zoo because most zoos are very depressing. They're getting better over time. But most zoos are fairly depressing. What they've done with the animals in this zoo is they've had trainers work with the animals so that they're comfortable with people. And although people can't, you know, just jump into the pens and interact with them, they do have a real open kind of feel to all the animal places that the animals are. And actually, they've got giraffes that are quite gentle. And the giraffes are, they're huge. I mean, their heads stick way the hell up. So you have to climb up this kind of wooden walkway, and you get to the top, and you can buy food there. And you hold the food in your hand. And the giraffes stick their heads over, and these long, prehensile tongues that are like the size of my arm come out. Pardon me?
What zoo is it?
It's called the Brevard Zoo. It's a smallish zoo, but they've, you know, they've got enough money to... They have primates, and they have a nice primate island, actually, where the gorillas and the chimps sort of swing freely. And there's a lot of stuff, a lot of emphasis on kids, on working with school children, stuff like that. It's hard times now because of the recession, so they're kind of scrambling to keep it going decently. But I think they're doing okay. Yeah. And who are you?
My name is Luke Salyer. I'm a BSIT major in my sophomore, juniorish year.
Now, is that something dirty? Why do you have to spell that?
Bachelor of Science in Information Technology.
Okay. All right. So it is dirty. You're the people who brought us internet porn, now that I think
about
it.
Exactly. Yeah. I want to make sure you have it all 24/7.
What are you going to do with the degree?
I have no idea.
Do you want to work in IT?
I used to be a network administrator a couple years ago, and I don't know if I want to go back into the field or not. But
yeah.
So.
How's it going in the area? Is the market still pretty close?
I actually don't know. I just moved up here in June.
Where are you from?
All over. I'm originally from Southern California. Mm-hmm. I lived in North Carolina, Virginia. So.
Yeah, you kind of got a generic sort of West Coast Southern accent.
So people tell me.
Yeah. Okay, well, welcome to the class. When I have problems, you can come to my assistance.
I'm Allie. I'm a transfer student from the University of Delaware.
Wow, a lot of transfer students.
Yeah, I know. I think it's safe to
say. Yeah. University of Delaware, that's that state that's near New Jersey?
That's that state that no one knows is a state, but it really is a state. So,
do you go to the Delaware Water Gap and see whether you can see the Indian Head and the...
I actually had to drive over that to get to school, so it's really not that interesting.
Yeah, I could never, the Indian, whenever I actually saw it, I went, so what?
It's like the most dull state, there was nothing to do down there.
But you're in the Chesapeake Bay, right? Don't you?
No, that's Virginia.
Oh, that's Virginia. That's Virginia. What the hell's in, the Delaware just had the Water Gap, huh?
Yeah, that's pretty much all they have.
Yeah, how boring. So you decided to come to Boston.
I did, I'm originally from Massachusetts, so I'm just happy to come back.
And were you exiled in Delaware? Did you do something wrong in Massachusetts?
No.
Did the state police catch you doing something and send you to Delaware?
Well, no.
No?
But, yeah, it just wasn't my scene, you know.
Yeah. And do you have a major?
Yeah, criminal justice.
Criminal justice. Okay. So you talk to him and, you know,
yeah.
Get in tight, okay? And who the hell are you?
Hey, my name is Walker. I'm a biotechnology major. And
no, you're not.
Yeah.
I know you are, it's true, but, okay.
My soul is a philosopher's soul.
Yeah. Tell us where you're from, Walker.
I'm from Peru.
Walker is from Peru, and he just brought me back. Now, this is something that you must follow Walker in. He brought me back a fantastic box of chocolates from Peru. Made from, the people who made the chocolates also made the box from a tree that grows only in that part of Peru. Am I right about that?
Sir.
Yeah, and I expect that level of bribery from you, too. Tell us how you got interested in philosophy, Walker.
Actually, I took philosophy one. I came as a transfer from Peru 2 years ago, no, a year and a half. I took philosophy 100 because I needed a humanities requirement, and I fell in love with the class, and I wanted to change my major, but it was way too late. So now I'm going to grad school for philosophy.
Oh, by the way, I got some concrete information for you about programs. So talk to me after class, okay? Yeah, Walker and I have known each other for a while. He's a real good guy, in spite of appearances. I'm glad you came to the class. And who are you?
My name's Apton. I'm a sophomore.
Say it again.
Apton.
Yeah. Apton. And you're a sophomore?
Yeah.
And what are you majoring in?
I'm a bio major.
You're a bio major. Uh-huh. Do you know Walker?
I don't know Walker, no, I do know.
Now, maybe you can buy his exam results from previous years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lab reports are actually...
Lab reports, bio. Yeah. We try to facilitate students cooperating with one another in this class. But if anybody has any papers they want to sell, then welcome to the class. And who are you?
I'm Gabby. I'm the English major, and I'm a senior.
You're a senior. And, okay, so you're... Now, what in the world do you do with an English degree?
I don't know.
Yeah. That's okay. They used to ask me what in the world I would do with a philosophy degree. They tried to warn me against it, and they were absolutely right. So learn from my mistakes. Welcome to, you're not transferring in from anywhere?
Kind of, sort of. I've been here for a couple of years. I went to school in Montana, and I've been to school in Vegas.
Wow, in Vegas?
Yeah.
I hesitate to ask you what kind of school you went to in Vegas.
I went to UNLV.
Huh? UNLV. I remember talking to a counselor, a college advisor, an academic advisor from Vegas, at a conference once. This was maybe about 10 years ago, and he told me that the wages and salaries in Vegas were extremely high. And he said that he had a student who was a parked cars for a living, who made over $100,000 a year. What happened was Vegas, the unions were able to unionize the hotels. And they unionized them en masse, and they were able to get wages up for people who worked in the hotels. And then as the wages for the hotel workers went up, since hotels dominate Vegas, it spilled over to the rest of the economy. But I understand now things are not so great because of the recession. Fewer people are going to gamble and stuff like that. Did you like studying in Vegas?
I get distracted by bright lights.
Yeah, it's the wrong place to be if you're distracted by bright lights. I only drove through Vegas once. I never even stopped. I think I might have played a slot machine in Reno at a roadside cafe or something. But that's as much of Vegas culture as I know. Who are you?
I'm Dan. I'm a nursing student here in the clinicals, which for you other nursing students is not easy.
You're doing clinicals, and that means you're in the field?
Yeah.
And what are you doing in the field?
Just applying what you learned in the prerequisites. It's a lot of just patient care.
Have you killed anybody yet?
I mean, I've come close. I'm also an EMT, so I do that too. So
how long have you been doing that?
Like 3 or 4 years.
Why don't you tell people what an EMT is in case they don't know?
It's an emergency medical technician. Work on an ambulance with a partner, and I mean, you save people.
Yeah, that's quite a job.
Work in conjunction with the fire department. You move patients around of different capacities, I suppose.
Right.
We've had patients that have weighed up to 1,000 pounds.
So why are you looking at me when you say that? Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Have you ever been in the ambulance with no patient in it and put the siren on and gone really fast? Because of the state cop, right? Yeah, I know you have. Everybody knows you have. I know, but everybody knows you have. And besides, another question I've got is, have you ever been in your cop car late at night, you had no official business to do, but you wanted to get home fast?
Yes, I have.
And put the siren on? Citizen's arrest. Yes, and who are you? Yeah. You're from Vietnam. And how long have you been in the States?
6 years.
6 years. Okay. And you said you're a biotech?
Bio major.
A bio major. Do you want to do biotech?
No.
Nah, yeah, that's where the jobs are, you know. There's a new biotech company sprouting up in Kendall Square every 5 minutes, it seems like. It's really quite amazing. And okay, so and you're, what year are you in again? You're a sophomore biology major in Vietnam. Welcome to the class.
My name is Kevin. I'm from Falmouth.
From Falmouth?
Yeah.
And when did you transfer to Boston?
I didn't transfer.
Oh, you didn't transfer.
I'm at Harvard Point now. I'm a political science major.
Oh, yeah? And what is it that you would like to do with a political science degree?
I have no idea.
Good. No. Good. I actually like that answer. I like that answer. A lot of people think that their degree is somehow related to their the rest of their lives. That's unusual, actually. Who are you?
My name is Griselda.
Griselda.
Yes, and I am a transfer student from Urban College of Boston, which is early education and care, and that's what I'm continuing here, early education and care.
Oh, no kidding. I need a lot of that. Not the early education, but the care. So you're in the you're also in the education.
Yes.
So is there education? The school is a graduate school, right? There's the graduate school of education. There's no undergraduate school of education, right? But you're able to take education classes and get certified.
Correct.
Yeah. And who is it who guides you through that process? Do you go? Is it somebody at the graduate college?
It's what they call the ESAMS program.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's
So when you get in, you talk to advisors there,
yeah,
and they tell you which classes you need to take and that kind of stuff. Okay. Well, welcome to the class. And you are?
I'm Amy Lozano, a transfer student at the University of Puerto Rico. Over there, I was in my third year. You guys said I'm in my sophomore year, but I don't know if I'm in the second half of my sophomore year or the first.
Okay,
year.
You're with the rest of UMass students.
Yeah. I'm studying business. I think I like management and human resources, but I'm not too sure. I'm still open for...
I have a former student who ended up working for the Human Resources Department here and sort of shot up, worked her way up over the years. And she's really very dear to me because I went to her office once after she started to move up in the Human Resources program. And she was negotiating for the contract for secretaries and I forget whether she did janitorial negotiations or not, but she was representing the administration. But when I went into her office, I saw photographs of her on her walls. And there were photographs of her as a little girl walking with a picket sign on her father's picket line. And so her boss, who's the head of human resources here, who's a very nice guy, by the way, would say to her before she went into the negotiating sessions, he would say to her, remember that you're representing management and not labor. Because her heart was with the workers, but she's done really well in human resources, and actually you could go over and talk to people there.
Right.
It's a good program, actually. It's a good department at UMass. Mm-hmm. Yes, and who are you?
My name is Matt. I'm a transfer student from James Madison. A couple credits left on the senior.
Ah, okay. And where's James Madison?
It's in Virginia.
And you've come up north, or you're coming back home?
I'm coming back.
Coming back home. So you're from this area?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what part?
I'm from Easton. I live in Brighton now.
Ah, okay. All right, I lived in Brighton for it. Cool. It's been colonized now by BU students, right? Rich BU students? Yeah, don't you hate them? Actually, I went to BU. That's where I got my doctorate, and that's when I was living there. But I also hated them, so.
My name is Jennifer, and I have not declared a major.
Good for you. And you're a senior?
No. I'm a sophomore.
Yeah. I have a friend who was at Columbia, and he was majoring in English, and English literature. And his senior year, he wrote a paper for actually somebody well-known who came to teach for the English department at Columbia. And the guy reads his paper, and he says, thank God you're only a freshman. We still have 4 years to teach you how to write. And he was about to graduate. Welcome to the class. Do you have any idea about what you're going to major in?
I would like to be a nurse.
A nurse? Oh, okay. You've got people to talk to. But yeah. Listen, who are you?
I'm Jessica.
Jessica.
And I'm between sophomore and junior, I guess, as well. And I kind of don't know what I'm going to be doing with my degree. I've kind of been dabbling in a lot of things right now.
Yeah.
I'm kind of leaning towards early childhood program.
Oh, there you go.
I need to get that GPA up before I get on that.
There you go. See, yeah, you picked the right person to sit next to. The two of you can plot together. And tell us who you are.
My name is Danielle. I'm a senior. It's my last semester here.
Yes, and you took a class with me already, Danielle.
Yes.
Which class was it?
It was medical ethics.
Yeah, it's medical ethics. Yeah.
A philosophy major.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's good to have you back. And you're finishing this year?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what in the world are you going to do with a philosophy degree?
I think I'm applying to law school.
Yeah, well, you know,
I have reservations, but it's kind of...
You have reservations for law school?
Law school.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, actually, there's a very high rate of acceptance. It's the highest for any major. Philosophy majors get into law school more frequently than any other major. So if you're interested in law school, philosophy is a good way to it. Mm-hmm. You thinking about a particular kind of law?
Not really. I kind of say labor law because I'm a waitress.
So ah. So you want to screw the bosses? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I have a good friend who's a labor lawyer. Actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No. It's a good thing to do. It's to you know, put it to your former employers.
Yeah.
Welcome back. And who are you?
Hi. My name is Lucy. I'm a sophomore.
You're undeclared.
Undeclared.
And are you thinking about declaration?
I want to do nursing.
You want to do nursing. All right, so I'm curious, how many people are transfer students? You said to me they're transferring. Look at this. Look around. My God. Boston is a beacon. A beacon for transfers. At least a beacon for people coming back. Okay, well, it's good to know everybody. For people who are showing up for the first time, I am Gary Zabel. I'm teaching this class. I've been teaching here for 21 years. So I am jaded and cynical and all those other things about UMass. But the great thing about UMass is its student body, which is really quite unique for the Boston area. People who go to school here generally are working or they have family responsibilities. They're somehow integrated into the city. They're not just passing through. And most universities in Boston, of course, are catching students passing through. So it's kind of nice to be in the real Boston, which is where you are now. Since we've got people who are just joining the class, and since I'm out of syllabi, that's not a big deal. Let me show you why it's not a big deal, and I will use the computer to do that. So just give it a second, and the projector should come up, and this thing should still be connected. Come on, folks. Pull this out here. Yes.
I registered for this class last week, but it didn't appear in my Blackboard. Do you know why? Do I have to enter?
For this class?
Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't appear in Blackboard, it would appear in Wiser.
That it's on that. I was trying to get to the syllabus, but do you have
to? He has no independent website.
I see what you're talking about. Yeah, that's what I'm going to show you right now.
Okay.
And I'll show you how to do that. Here we go. Okay. Let me do it. Yeah, I got this. I'm going to start using. I'm teaching an online course this term, so I'm using Blackboard, and I'm just beginning to realize what the strengths of it are. So I think I will put my courses in the future on Blackboard, but right now this course is on my faculty website, and you'll see in a second what that means. Let me just arrange them here. That's not going to do it either. I'm a little bit off in terms of resolution, but I don't care as long as I can. Well, actually, hold on a second. System preferences, blah, 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 displays. Let's see how we want to do this. No? Let's try this one. I never know which setting to put this on. Let me try one more here. It's weird. I don't have the higher resolutions, but for some reason I can't drag these. Oh, wait. Here we go. Okay. Wait. You. Arranged by name. I should have got. This is terrible. Okay, this is my. There we go. All right, there's your incredibly handsome professor. This is my faculty website, and the address, I don't know whether you can make it out, it's www.faculty.umb.edu/ Gary, my first name, underscore, and then Zabel, which is my last name. You don't need the index. If you just type that part in, alternatively, just Google my name. Just Google Gary Zabel, and the first link that comes up is the link to this website. So, you know, that's the easiest way to do it. Just Google my name, you'll come up with this website. And this is the home page, obviously. And so you can read this, you can learn all about me, fascinating person that I am. And, wait a second. And then as you scroll down, you get to other resources. And the resource that you're immediately interested in is course syllabi. Okay, so you click on course syllabi. This has to be, I have to put a space in here. You click on course syllabi, and then you'll see this, which has got my classes on electronically. And then you want to click, obviously, on Moral and Social Problems, Bill 108. And then this page comes up. This page is essentially it's the syllabus. What I handed out last time was a printout of just the text of this page. And as you read along, it'll describe what the topic of the course is. And since we have so many people joining for the first time, let me, at the risk of repeating myself, tell you that this is a course that focuses on moral and social problems that have their proper context in the expansion and decline of empire. I've taught this course in the past, and I began by teaching it the way most professors teach moral and social problems. Namely, I began by teaching about abortion, affirmative action, capital punishment, and so forth. And I quickly got bored doing that. And the reason why is that, as I said last time, these are issues that almost everybody in our society has some position on. You know, either by the time you get to college, either you're pro-abortion or you're opposed to it. You know, in other words, I should say you're either pro-choice or you're pro-life. You are either in favor of capital punishment or you reject it. You are either in favor of affirmative action or you think it's an injustice, and so on. And so teaching those topics tends to become a yelling match between people who are already committed to a position and who are not going to change their minds. There are reasons why that's the case. They're interesting reasons. But you know, we can talk about them as the course goes on. But as far as the actual process of teaching is concerned, it's very boring from my perspective to teach topics that no one is going to budge on no matter what. And so instead of doing that, I've tended to look for areas in which moral and ethical questions are emerging in new ways, ways that people have not yet developed settled opinions on, or at least to some extent have not yet made up their minds about. So for example, I gave a course once under the Phil 108 rubric on moral and social problems in the new microtechnologies and the new genetic technologies. Now, a lot of people don't have settled opinions about whether, for example, it's the right thing to do to select the eye color of one's not yet born child. But that seems frivolous, but there are other questions that are related to bioethics and to the ethics of microtechnology, which are a little bit more difficult to take a position on. For example, should genetic medicine be used simply to heal genetic disorders, or should it be used in order to enhance human capabilities? I mean, the same genetic medicine that conceivably could, for example, cure Tay-Sachs disorder or some of the other genetically inherited diseases, with a certain twist, might be able to increase the capacities of the normal person. Let me give you a microelectronic example. It's possible now to restore the vision of some blind people, by implanting artificial retinas in their eyes. And the retinas are microelectronic devices which collect light and then channel that
what those light impulses to the optic nerve, where it then goes into the brain and is processed. But when you have an artificial retina, there's no need to limit it to the visible light spectrum, the light spectrum that ordinary people see. You can develop an artificial retina that is sensitive to infrared radiation, which is essentially night vision. Right? U.S. Army uses infrared scopes so that soldiers can see targets at night. Or you could extend it to the ultraviolet part of the spectrum. And if that's the case, then why simply limit artificial retinas to the blind? Why not install them in the eyes of people who are normally sighted? You know, that conceivably could be a way of extending their visual possibilities. Not immediately clear what's the right thing and what's the wrong thing to do. I mean, should we be pursuing that or should we not be pursuing that? There are a whole range of questions that we are facing for the first time. You know, people have not had to answer that question before, obviously, before the late 20th, early 21st centuries. And there are other questions that people have not had to answer. This course is not so much focused on that, although we are going to get into microelectronics when we talk about the new surveillance technologies. This course is focused on a theme that, in a sense, is quite ancient, and yet in its contemporary manifestation is very new at the same time. And what I'm talking about is the growth and decline of empire. Now, it depends upon how you read modern history, but one reading is that ever since the end of the Second World War, the U.S. has played the role of the imperial hegemon. I don't know if you, people who are political science majors may recognize the word hegemonic. Hegemonic simply means dominant. And it's clear that for the past 500 years, we've lived in a world system in which a single nation state has been hegemonic at any particular time. So first, for example, it was Spain. Spain and Portugal to some degree. Those are the countries that launched the great voyages of discovery in the 1500s. Those are the countries that expanded European influence to Africa, to Asia, to the Americas. And those were the countries that accumulated wealth that was extracted from the Americas, organized the slave trade, in the case of the Portuguese, and so forth. As soon as Spain, call it Iberia, Spain and Portugal, as soon as Iberia reached a position of global hegemony, they held it for about 100 years, but they were immediately challenged by other contenders, and in particular, they were challenged by one of their own European colonies, namely Holland, which defeated the French in a revolutionary war of independence, and in the process became the global hegemon. We don't think of Holland as a dominant world nation, but for about 100 years, 150 years, Holland was the dominant nation globally. It developed colonies in America. You know, New York was originally New Amsterdam. It developed a very important colony which had only relinquished in the 20th century, late 20th century, namely Indonesia. It was a center in which wealth was accumulated, in which culture began to take off in the form of the oil paintings of, you know, the great Dutch masters and so forth. It was a dynamic society that through its naval fleet controlled a great deal of commercial activity throughout the world and so on. But once again, it was challenged. And it was challenged by two nations who were contending for the position of global hegemon. One was France and one was England. This was a very bloody period in which those two nations squared off against one another in various parts of the world. The American Revolution was a part of that. You know, the French supported the American colonists. Not because they were particularly enamored of the colonists, but because they saw it as a way of weakening England, who was their competitor for global dominance. Now, finally, after a long battle and bloody battle between France and England, England won by defeating Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo. And England assured its dominance as the primary imperial power for,
1814 until, I would say, 1945. Almost 130 years or so. Of course, England was then challenged by Germany, and that's what the First and the Second World Wars were all about. Germany was defeated, but England was sapped of its strength in the process of fighting two world wars. And as a result of that, in the period following the Second World War, England lost its colonies. And there were great decolonization movements throughout the world. India achieved independence. The African nations achieved independence from their European masters. A number of Caribbean nations did the same. In Asia, same process was going on. But the global hegemon very clearly became the United States from 1945, the end of the Second World War, to the present. Now it looks like, at least in the estimation of some people, we're beginning to live through the epoch of decline of American empire. You know, the ability of the U.S. to control things globally is really being sapped. We can see this from the completely futile war that was fought in Iraq. We can see this from the really, since it's a live issue, I don't want to prejudice it, but from the unnerving, let's say, extension of war on a large scale to Afghanistan. We can see it in the economic collapse that occurred a year and a half ago. We can see it in the fact that the U.S. is now a debtor nation. By the way, most of whose debt, or a good chunk of whose debt, is owned by China, which is rising as an economic power and as a global power and so forth. So we seem to be at this period of shift again in the modern world system, in which the global hegemon is challenged and ultimately undone. Problem is, what is it that makes this new? Well, one of the things that makes this new is, first of all, the incredible development of weaponry of, as they say, mass destruction, right? Most of which is actually in American arsenals. What I'm talking about is nuclear weapons. Yeah, the former Soviet Union, Russia has a bunch of these things too. But clearly, the only remaining superpower after the Soviet Union collapsed is the United States, which also has the only military that's capable of projecting power, as they say, around the world. There is not another military in existence, including the Chinese military, that is in a position to challenge U.S. military might. Well, we've never been in that position before. We have a military which is the strongest in the world, in a nation that is experiencing symptoms of imperial decline with no clear competitor waiting in the wings to take over at least the military role of the U.S. We also have, of course, new developments. The development of networks of terrorists, which, and I know that a lot of people sort of scoff, a lot of liberals in particular scoff at the idea of somebody getting a hold of a nuclear bomb, of a suitcase, so-called suitcase bomb, but it seems to me it's inevitable that that will happen. At some point there will be some non-state actor, as they say, who figures out how to get a hold of plutonium. We already know how to make bombs. You can look it up on the internet. The only problem is getting a hold of plutonium. And once you've gotten a hold of plutonium, making a bomb is a cinch. And so we're dealing with that. We're dealing with globalization, in which the world economy is more integrated than ever before, in which what happens in one region affects what happens everywhere. In other words, we have a slew of new problems and new issues cropping up. But I think that they're best conceived of as problems and issues having to do with the assertion and decline of imperial power. Now, this creates a connection with the past. And the connection with the past is one that I'm not the first to make, obviously. It's been made time and again by other people. The connection with the past is the connection with the Roman Empire. And I'd like to extend that to the empire that immediately preceded it, namely the Macedonian Empire, the empire of Alexander the Great. You know, why reach back to that epoch? Why not just begin with questions of, you know, nuclear proliferation, or what to do about war and peace, what to do about the global economy and so forth, what kinds of moral and social issues are raised there? I think the reason is that
philosophers, at least of my persuasion, and I'm not the my persuasion is not the majority in the U.S. It is the majority in Europe, and in particular in Germany, but in the U.S. not so. Philosophers of my persuasion like to say that that philosophical thought is essentially historical in character. If you lose the historical dimension, you lose what it's all about. Philosophers who tend to teach in the United States and in England take a different position. For them, philosophical conversations are, it's as though it makes no difference what time period the person talking inhabits. It's as though all philosophers everywhere, at every time in history, are having the same conversation with one another about what truth is, about what actually exists, about what people ought to do. And in my view, that's absurd. In my view, philosophers are creatures of their time, every bit as much as you and I are creatures of their time. The philosophical questions that they address are questions that are appropriate to their time period. Now, sometimes it's possible to say something that has an effect down through the ages. People will read and reread Spinoza, one of my favorite philosophers, or Plato, and get something out of those people, but they will only get something out of those people if they translate them into the particular circumstances that they themselves face. In other words, in moral philosophy above all, the question that you're being posed with is the following. What should I do under these particular circumstances? How ought I to act under these particular circumstances? And when I say these particular circumstances, you have to fill into that the circumstances of somebody living in the United States in a major urban area in the first decade, or actually not the second decade, no, I guess we're at the end of the first decade, in the first decade of the 21st century. You know, we're not ancient Greeks, and we're not early moderns. Now, I haven't worn a powdered wig in years, all right? We are inhabitants of the early 21st century, and we face a range of questions that's unique to our position in history. Well, in a way, that sounds like philosophers of the past would have nothing to say to us. But I don't think that's true. And the reason why I don't think that's true, there are two reasons. One is that great philosophers of the past, especially great moral philosophers, have been geniuses at raising the question, what should I do under their particular circumstances? In other words, they give us examples of how to do moral philosophy. They're doing moral philosophy for their own time period, but they're doing it in the same way that we have to do it now, namely for our time period. But there's another connection, which I think is stronger than that. And that is, it's true that we live in the early 21st century and that we're dealing with a range of questions that is unique to us. But history also has great continuities. Things change, certainly, but patterns also get repeated. They get repeated in ways that are different than their original appearance, but that nonetheless are connected with their original appearance. And the problem of empire in the modern period is a repetition under new circumstances of the problem of empire in the ancient world. Now, why the ancient world? Why are philosophers so hot about Greece anyway? Why are they so taken with ancient Greece and to some extent, to a lesser extent, with Rome? We're going to start with Greece. Why are they so taken with Greece? Walker? Why are philosophers so hot and heavy about Greece?
Because the foundations of all the philosophy that follows started there.
Yeah, all the Western philosophy.
All the Western philosophy.
Yeah, China, by the way, is an interesting case because China, at the same time that the Greeks are inventing philosophy for the West,
The Chinese are inventing philosophy for the East. It's an independent development, but it's a development that is runs in parallel to the development in Greece and in the Western part of the world. Not only that, but at the same time, the Chinese are developing philosophy in the East, and the Greeks are developing it. I said the West, but actually in Central Eurasia, I guess is the way to put it. Part of the Greek world lived on the west coast of Asia Minor, in places that we now call nation, like Turkey, places like that. But at the same time that they were making path-breaking developments, the Chinese were making them. The Indians were making them in the form of a revolution that took place both in philosophy and in religion, namely with the development of Buddhism, which changed a great deal in India at the time. And the Jews were revolutionizing the religious tradition of the Mideast through the prophets. So what you had was ancient philosophy arising in Greece, Chinese philosophy arising in China, Buddhism arising in India, and the prophetic tradition arising in the Middle East, all at the same time, roughly. This is the time period that I'm talking about is between 500 BC, BCE, before the Common Era, and 200 BCE. You say BCE to be politically correct, it should be BC before Christ and AD, the year of our Lord. But now we recognize that not everybody is a Christian. Took us a while to figure that out in the United States. Not everybody is a Christian. So now what do we do? We say before the Common Era. But the Common Era begins with the birth of Christ. So we're identifying what's common to all of humanity with Christ's birth. And so we divide up, in other words, there is no gain on that play. This is an example of political correctness that has no point to it. BC, AD if you want, BCE, CE if you want. It means exactly the same thing. Everybody knows what it means. It means the period before we think Christ was born and the period after we think Christ was born, right? From 5000 BCE to around 500 BCE to around 200 BCE was the period that Karl Jaspers, who is a German philosopher, called the Axial Age. The Axial Age. This is the first time that human civilization, which is already at this point about 3,000 years old, right? And the great Egyptian civilization and the Mesopotamian civilization go back 3,000 years before this period. It's already 3,000 years old. This is the first time that people begin to reflect about the nature of what's right and wrong, about what is really genuinely real. And they begin to make distinctions between reality and appearance. They begin to develop moral discourse in a way that is sometimes almost revolutionary. I'm thinking about the Jewish prophets who come along and say the community lies in sin. And why? Because the rich grind the faces of the poor into the dirt. What you have here is really almost a revolutionary message coming out of ancient Judaism that gets carried on in early Christianity too, by the way. Jesus says it's harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the portals of heaven. And who's going to inherit the kingdom? It's not the mighty. It's the meek. It's the poor. It's the poor, people who have no money and the poor in spirit. The people who do not elevate themselves above everybody else. Well, this is a later reverberation of the Axial Age. In other words, in the Axial Age, human thought begins taking a turn. It's a turn that is reflective, that involves deep consideration of problems that human beings face as human. In ancient Greece, that turn is philosophical in nature. The Greeks are not very interested in religion. I'll tell you. Sure, they had gods and goddesses. But who were the gods and goddesses? They were people, they were beings about whom really interesting stories were told. and in particular stories about who was stepping out on whom. You know, who was Zeus really having an affair with behind Hera's back, right? That kind of thing. You know, what was the? Did you know that Zeus really envied his father Cronos, and he actually crept into the old man's room when he Zeus was young, and he castrated his father and then killed him. Now that's an interesting story. It's very little to do with religion, right? That's more like I don't know what, reality TV. That's Oprah, right? I don't know. But in any event, the Greeks don't have a particular interest in religion. What they have is an interest in rational discourse, in understanding the world by reasoning it out. And ultimately, this becomes the seed that gives rise to philosophy. There are three great figures, and I'm repeating myself a bit, but remember we've got about half of the class that's joining for the first time. There were three great figures in the history of ancient philosophy, three great inventors of philosophy, especially of moral philosophy: Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Socrates died in 399 at the age of 70. Plato was about two generations younger than Socrates. He was about the generation of Socrates' grandchildren and a student of Socrates. And Aristotle was about a generation younger than Plato and a student of Plato. These three figures dominated Greek philosophy, and they dominated Greek ethics. And it's even been said that the origins of Greek philosophy really lie in the creation of ethics or moral philosophy, which is the same thing from our perspective. We're going to use those words interchangeably. So before this, there were scientists, and some of them are called natural philosophers. These are people who lived on the west coast of Asia Minor in what is now called Turkey. They were Greeks, though. They were Greeks who colonized the west coast of Asia Minor. And they began looking up at the sky and asking, why is it that there are patterns in the cosmos? Why do the same stars return to the same points in the sky year after year? Every 365 days. Why does the night sky return to its previous position 1 year prior? What are the stars made out of? What's the significance of the heavens? You know, are they alive, or is it simply dead matter revolving in great circles? What's the meaning of all this? What's the significance of it? How did the universe come into existence? These are scientific questions. These are the same questions that cosmologists now raise and that astronomers now raise in our universities. Philosophy begins when that kind of rational questioning moves from the heaven to the earth. And the key figure who is responsible for that movement from the heaven to the earth is Socrates. Socrates tells us that he began with an interest in questions of natural science. But the reason why was that he was looking for an answer to the following question: what is the good? What is the good? What is the best way for things to be? And he had heard that there was a natural philosopher named Anaxagoras who had written a book in which he argued that mind steered all things. That mind, nous in Greek, steered all things. And Socrates, and very excitedly, went to one of the bookstalls of ancient Athens and bought the book by Anaxagoras, and he read it avidly, thinking that he would get an answer to his question, why do things exist the way they do? Why is it best for them to exist the way they do? Why is it best for the universe to be in the condition that it's in? And he thought if there was an answer to that question, surely it would lie in the mind that steers the universe. But when he looked, he couldn't find any good account of what mind is. For Anaxagoras, mind was simply what started the universe moving. It's what gave everything a big push so that a great vortex occurred and the heavy elements of Earth in particular coagulated at the center the way that dirt will coagulate around a drain when you, you know, if you have dirt in the kitchen sink and you pull the plug out, you'll see a vortex in which the dirt tends toward the center of the vortex. All that mind did for Anaxagoras was get that vortex moving, the big universal vortex that brought the element Earth to the center and that then created the stars and the concentric circles and so forth. No answer to the question of what the good is or what the best is. So Socrates says, I took a second route here. I gave up natural philosophy and I began going into the city and asking questions of people. And in particular, I did this, and there's an account that has to do with Socrates' life's mission here that I guess, I can go into briefly. When Socrates was a young man, a friend of his went to the Oracle at Delphi. The Oracle at Delphi was actually a priestess who was the priestess of Apollo. Delphi is a town about 30 miles north of Athens, maybe 50 miles north of Athens, in the mountains. And there was a great temple of Apollo at Delphi. The priestess of Apollo presided over the temple, and what she did, among other things, was act as an oracle. Now, an oracle is an entity of which one asks questions. In China, the I Ching is used as an oracle. The I Ching is a book, and you throw yarrow stalks or coins to figure out what the book tells you in response to a question. Should I go to law school? Should I become a nurse? You throw the I Ching, and it gives you a reading from the various passages in the book, depending upon the way the coins fall and where the yarrow stalks fall. In ancient Greece, the oracle was the priestess of Apollo. And the priestess would sit on a tripod over a hole in the ground. It's like this. This is Delphi. Delphi was volcanic. Now, much of the ancient Mediterranean was volcanic. Vesuvius was covered in volcanic ash. You can go visit the remains of Vesuvius now in Italy. Sicily was, there was lava flowing, you know, all over the place in Sicily. Greece also had volcanic activity. There was low-level dormant volcanic activity or slow-level volcanic activity in Delphi. And so there was a hole in the earth from which fumes emerged, volcanic fumes. The priestess of Apollo sat on a tripod that was erected by her assistants. She sat on the tripod and she inhaled the fumes. And when she inhaled the fumes, she went into a trance state. And when she was in the trance state, when she spoke, it was not the priestess speaking, it was the god Apollo speaking through her.
Do they know what the fumes were?
They're volcanic. You want to go? You can go now. Go sit on top of a live volcano and sniff.
Okay. Is it just like sulfur and stuff like that? Or
yeah, this was not an hallucinogen. There does seem to have been hallucinogenic use of hallucinogens in other parts of Greek religion, but not in this one. In this one, she inhaled the volcanic fumes, and basically what happened is she goes into a trance state, I suppose, because oxygen is deprived. She's not getting enough oxygen to the brain, but she then speaks in Apollo's voice. So Socrates' friend went to the Oracle of Delphi and he said, who is the wisest person in Greece? And so the priestess goes into her trance after she gets a little bit of money from the guy. Now, no religion happens without a palm being greased. You got to grease the priestess's palm. She goes into her trance and she says, Socrates is the wisest person in Greece. God Apollo is speaking to her. Socrates is the wisest person in Greece. Socrates' friend goes to him, and Socrates is a relatively young man, 25, 30 years old, and he says, the oracle said, you're the wisest person in Greece. And Socrates replies on default. Now, how is this possible? I lack knowledge of the only thing that counts. What is the only thing that counts? The only thing that counts is knowledge of the good. And by the good, what Socrates means is knowledge of the best way for human beings to live. I lack knowledge of the only thing that counts. I don't know what the best way is for human beings to live. What could the god Apollo possibly mean by telling me that I am the wisest person in Greece when I know I lack exactly that knowledge that's significant, namely, the proper way for human beings to live? And so he takes it as his mission, his religious mission, to find out what the god meant. I should tell you that in Greek society, when the oracle makes a pronouncement, the oracle speaks in riddles. The oracle does not say straightforwardly what the oracle means. It's up to you to figure out what the riddle signifies. So, in order to figure out what the riddle signifies, Socrates went around from expert to expert in his society. People who ought to have some expert knowledge of the proper way to live. Generals should be experts in what courage is. Whatever the good is for human beings, part of it has got to involve being courageous in the appropriate circumstances. Or he would go around and talk to people who fancy themselves experts in law and ask them what justice is. Now, whatever the human good is, part of it has got to involve being just. Or he would go around to religious officials and ask what religious piety is, and so forth and so on. Expecting to find people wiser than he. But whenever he questioned an expert in Athenian society about what the virtue that the person claimed expertise in actually is, he got an answer that could not be defended by that person. For example, there were four main virtues in ancient Greece. There was wisdom, justice, courage, and moderation. Wisdom, justice, courage, and moderation. Someone living a life that is fit for a human being would presumably embody all four virtues. They would be wise, they would be just, they would be courageous, and they would be moderate. He would go to a general and say, look, you must be an expert in courage, because after all, men on the battlefield need to be courageous, and you've trained whole armies. So tell me what courage is. And the general would reply, courage is the act of standing your ground in the face of an overwhelming enemy assault. That's what courage is. Is that courage? Courage is the act of standing your ground in the face of an enemy assault. Is that what courage is?
It's an application of courage.
Is it always an application of courage to stand your ground in the face of an enemy assault?
No.
Say it again?
I'd say it's just a portion of it.
But you think it's always courageous to stand one's ground in the face of an enemy assault, but that there are other things that are courageous too?
Say courage depends on the situation.
How does it depend on the situation? In the case of the enemy assault, how does it depend on that situation?
Pass. I'm going to tell you right now. Maybe I'm a third class. I don't know.
Yeah, need a beer first?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. But here's the situation. The general has ordered the men to stand their ground. Is there ever a situation in which it is not courageous for the soldiers to stand their ground?
No.
No? You say no.
I say no.
You say no.
I say no.
Why not?
because you're doing your duty.
Let me give you an example.
That's your job.
Yes.
That's your,
let me give you an example. Your general got drunk the night before, right? And he woke up with a hangover, and his adjutant said to him, what's the order of the day? And the general said, get out of here. You know, I got a hangover. I got a headache. Just tell the men to stay in their ground, hold their positions. Now, you're holding your position, and there is an overwhelming enemy contingent that your scouts tell you are about a mile off. And now they outnumber your men 10 to 1. No chance. No chance you're going to survive if you stand your ground. Is it courageous to stand your ground under those circumstances?
Mm-hmm.
It is. And why? Because your drunken general said so?
Because you've been given an order. It's your duty as a soldier.
Ah!
Now, just standing your ground doesn't mean you have to stand there stupidly. It means you have to come with some type of strategic, something strategic that gives you an advantage to hold off the enemy.
Well, if you've got, if you're outnumbered 10 to 1, what is that thing you're going to come up with?
You can come up with an ambush, you come up with a better defensive position.
Let's say you're outnumbered 100 to 1.
You still are a soldier with...
Let's jack it up to 1,000.
You're still a soldier with orders.
And what... Now, is it courageous to... Yes.
I think it's courageous to question your general's orders or to question what's visible to you. I think that would be more courageous than listening. If you know that, like...
You
mindlessly sacrifice the life of you and your men in order to follow an order which was given by somebody who did not know what the circumstances were on the field and who had a hangover at the time. Sounds to me like that's stupid. But there's a difference between stupidity and courage. In other words, you can sacrifice yourself to no good end. But what that does is that weakens the capacity of the army to resist the enemy. Isn't it really courageous in that situation to retreat? Are you willing to at least entertain the possibility?
I'll entertain the possibility, but...
Okay. But you see, if you're willing to entertain the possibility, you can imagine a circumstance in which it's courageous to retreat instead of standing your ground. Then the general's definition of courage is wrong. Courage cannot be the act of standing your ground in the face of an enemy assault, because there are times in which it is not courageous to do so. And through a process of questioning, Socrates would get the general to admit that. But to admit that means that the initial definition was wrong. And what that means is that the general did not know what he was talking about. The general claims to be an expert in courage, but was not an expert in courage. And what happens in the conversation always, and these conversations are written about by Plato, Socrates' student, what happens in the conversation always is Socrates says, let's continue to explore this issue. And the general or the legal specialist or whomever would say, well, I'd love to, but I have an appointment I have to go to. What the hell is that? I have an appointment to go to right now, and he'd leave. And through this process of asking what's justice, what's courage, and so forth, and finding no one in the society who could answer, Socrates decided that what the oracle meant was that he was the wisest person in Greece, because while everybody else thought they knew the answer to those questions, Socrates alone knew that he did not know. That wisdom in this case was knowledge of one's own ignorance. Well, this leaves a problem, right? I mean, Socrates dies. He's ultimately forced to carry out a capital punishment by taking hemlock. But the problem it creates is that Socrates has raised the question, what is justice? What is courage? First time this question is raised. I doubt that you've asked that question. Probably assumed that you knew what courage and justice were, right? I mean, asking the question is something that happens for the first time through Socrates. What is justice? What is courage? What is moderation? What is wisdom? He's raised these questions, and he's made these the central questions of moral philosophy, but he's been unable to answer them. He's given no answers. And this is what the philosophers who follow Socrates must do. Plato, and Aristotle in particular, must answer the questions that Socrates raised but could not himself answer. And in both cases, the case of Plato and in the case of Aristotle, we get moral philosophies which attempt to answer those questions. Plato's moral philosophy is beautiful. And, oh, geez, I'm sorry, I'm keeping you awfully late. Let's take a quick break, okay? Let's break for 10 minutes, and we will come back. And boy, the time really got away from me. And we'll continue this a little bit, all right? And I just want to get you to the point where you can begin to think about Epicurus, all right, who's the person we're supposed to be reading. Go grab, I don't know, take some stimulant drugs. The state trooper here, I'm sure, has some in the back of his.
You don't want to be kidding,
Get you know, punch yourself in the temples, get ready to come back, and what are you thinking, guys? Sure. Absolutely. Okay. Do you know what the readings are that you need to do? This is your first class.
My first class.
Okay. Take a look at this, all right? As you go along here, this is the web page that you'll get to. See Ethics in the Age of Empire? You're going to click on Epicureanism. It's actually the second link here.
Okay.
Click on Epicureanism and read these three.
Okay.
We're still going to be on these next week. Summary of Physical Nature, Happiness, and Principal Doctrines, all by Epicurus.
Yeah.
Okay? Okay.
Professor, seems
like
there's
one class here. What? You guys got class at 6 here?
Yeah.
We're going to have to return to our original rooms. Our original room. We've been supplanted by an enemy force, which doesn't outnumber us, but I'm afraid that justice is on their side. So we'll have to relocate. So we're going to go back.
Yeah, stand our ground.
Pardon?
Stand our ground.
Well, yeah, we can do that. That would be good. But we definitely prevail. We're going to have to move, folks. Back upstairs, sorry.
Is that next week back upstairs?
I don't know. I'll tell you what. There's a class coming in 6. So we need to go back upstairs, but I'm going to try to straighten this out. I'm going to try to get us a smart classroom that's actually available for the whole 2.5 hours. But next time, we will meet in the original classroom upstairs, okay, just to prevent confusion.
So we didn't have any papers or anything that we handed out.
Everything is on the website.
Online?
Everything. So when actually I showed them here, just take a quick look.
I kind of saw.
Did you see what I did? So on the main page here, what you want to do is this is the course page, right?
Mm-hmm.
The one you want to go to Epicureanism. I want to click on that.
I wanted to see the last because I almost got the entire URL.
Oh, you want to see the URL?
Yeah.
Just
I know you said Google.
It's that easy. It's
okay.
The first link.
Okay.
You Google me. It's invariably the first link.
Okay.
Okay. So just click on the first link. You get to Phil 108 finally, and you click on Epicureanism, and then you're going to read these three. Summary of Physical Nature, Happiness.
This is the time where I think we should stay that ground.
Yeah, well, I thought of it, but I also thought that would be an unmitigated use of violence rather than a manifestation of justice. So, I couldn't reasonably do it. I know we would win because we have the numbers. But
it's a full class coming in.
Oh, really? Yeah, but we can pick you off group by group. So.
Take
your younger. Yeah. Okay, we'll vacate for you. We have to go back to our original class.
What's your class from? When to when?
It's from 4 to 6:30.
4 to 6:30.
You see, and they've got us in a classroom without the internet and without a projector is the problem. Yeah.
The one next door, does that have a projector?
Is it available, did you say?
It's open.
It's open? It's possible that I can find another one. My experience is that if I request a room change from the administration, I'll get it the day before class ends.
Yeah, that's why I left.
You know? So in these situations, I just try to hunt for an open classroom.
I know. Oh, no, you're not.
Are you teaching this class?
No, I'm a student.
You
student?
Yep. Yeah.
I'm a book holder.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You do.
Ah.